Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 164 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sarah Kamen.
On today's show, we are talking the topic of tipping and fair wages in the restaurant world. Two people on the top of the debate, Brooklyn restaurateur and hotelier Andrew Tarlow of Diner Marlowe & Sons, The Wythe Hotel, just to name a few, and Saru Jayaraman, the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunities Center United and the director of the Food Labor Research Center at UC Berkeley. She's on the phone. Saru, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi.
Hi, welcome. Saru.
And Andrew, welcome.
Thank you.
Later in the show, we're going to talk a little bit about tipping and fair wages. After that, we'll take a break from the serious talk for the morning after quiz. But first, Sari, you've got some weird food news for us today.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. We talked a little bit about this.
This week wasn't that weird?
This week wasn't the weirdest week of all the weeks.
What about Trump?
That was weird. Not so much food. But I did hear that he likes his steaks well done, which, you know,
is really embarrassing.
We should judge him on that.
I do.
As long as we're judging him on everything else, we might as well judge him on that.
Yeah, but how do you think he tips?
I think he's a bad tipper.
Because no, I bet he considers himself a big tipper.
I think he does probably consider himself a big tipper, and I bet he goes 15%.
No.
Don't you think? Well, don't you think that tipping is really like, I mean, as long as we're talking about it, sort of like an indication of one true soul and being?
Yeah, I do. Absolutely. Yeah. I have seen
quite a few.
That's
what's hard when you take it away. That's where it gets really complicated.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
We're going to talk about that later.
The world is going to get darker, maybe.
Yeah, but some other things I wanted to bring up this week that are not Trump related. Thank God. We talked about this a little bit last week when you weren't here, Jesse, about some of the cheese products out there containing like wood. Have you guys heard about this?
No.
Yeah, it's in all the news. Apparently, a lot of like mostly processed Parmesan cheese contains not trace amounts, but like significant amounts of cellulose, which is something that contains wood pulp. So this controversy was like starting to happen. It's not new news, but like people are picking up on it. And now, as of this week, Walmart is getting sued for selling Parmesan cheese that contains this wood pulp.
I mean,
now what?
But like, is wood not digestible?
You know, it's funny that you ask. I think that's a great point. It's not that it's not digestible. It's just that it says it's 100% Parmesan cheese.
It's not labeled
cheese.
Right.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
So there's this guy, he like bought Parmesan cheese, you know, he spent like $2.34 and he didn't know it had wood in it. And so he's suing Walmart.
He's spending a little bit of money on a lawyer.
He's spending a little bit more
on the lawyer.
Yeah. And it's not like, we're not talking about like the wheels from Parma, you guys. Like those are fine.
It might not even be from Parma.
Like you're buying your cheese at Walmart, dude. Yeah. Let's start there.
Yeah. Is the milk from Italy?
Yeah. So okay. So we'll see. We'll let you know how that one
goes.
Yeah.
Good luck to you, man.
Yeah. I don't know.
I think he's going to win, actually.
I think he's going to win, too. Because
you're going to follow up on a future show?
I'm probably going to call him.
I bet you're going to follow up here. Like, we'll know the answer.
Oh, yeah.
We'll know what happens. Okay.
Yeah. You got it. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned for
the next ever.
CBD.
I mean, did it say anything about why they're putting cellulose in that? Because that's like a main component of a lot of vegetables.
Because then they can put less cheese.
It's an enzyme.
It's a filler. It's a filler.
It's an enzyme filler. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Okay. This next story has to do with everyone's favorite holiday of February, Valentine's Day, which is come
it's
and
already
gone.
Happened.
I know.
Okay.
But something. Thank you.
We talked about the news being difficult. All right.
Got it.
No,
it did happen. Already.
We're reaching back. This is a post-Valentine's story, Andrew. So actually, I am on trend. Thank you.
Okay.
So since Valentine's, a certain Whole Foods in Brookline, Mass, has been creating post-Valentine's Day cakes that say things like "We need to talk." Like, maybe people whose Valentine's didn't go as well as planned. So to help kind of like combat the awkwardness of like wanting a post-Valentine's breakup, say it with a cake.
Yeah.
Because breakups are delicious.
It's better than a text message?
It is better than a text message. And you hope that if you have a cake, you don't just send it in the mail. Like, you guys, like, break up, have this horrible time, and then
bring
the cake
to the front door, eat the cake together.
Like, hate, eat the cake.
Or throw it at each other, or something like
or
that.
Or, like, all of the above. There's so many ways
you to know
express
what, you
yourself.
Know what I saw? I saw a candy heart that said, it puts the lotion in the basket.
Anybody? I don't get it.
Silence of the Lambs.
Oh.
It's Bob.
Oh.
Oh. That's really how you break up with somebody, ouch. I think.
Yeah.
I got dumped on Valentine's Day.
This past Valentine's
Last
Day?
Valentine's
oh, this
Day.
Is Chef Lee DeRosier from Achilles Heel,
one
of Andrew's restaurants.
Where'd he come from?
God, is it you?
Wait, you got dumped on Valentine's Day?
I did not get a cake.
Did you? What did you get?
You got dumped.
I got nothing. I got dumped. It was cold.
You got dumped without a cake.
Just pain and a hangover?
He was working too much.
Yeah.
So it wasn't this past Valentine's Day?
Last one. No.
Wow.
Well, yeah. They're sorry now.
How was your Valentine's Day this year?
Also bad.
Why?
Well, the pipes froze at our restaurant.
Not romantic.
And water began pouring from the ceiling in the middle of dinner service.
Wow.
And we had to cut dinner short.
That sucks for everybody.
A couple of, yeah, well.
Nothing says love like cold water.
Nothing says like a closed restaurant.
Like a closed restaurant.
It was sad. I almost cried.
Oh.
Yeah.
I heard that happen to a couple other restaurateurs. Phil at Momo Sushi Shack, all of his pipes froze.
Oh, right.
And, like, Valentine's Day is a huge day for a lot of restaurants.
Extremely cold. Luckily, I was able to stay home and snuggle myself. So I was just fine. Thanks very much for reminding me of that. Moving on.
Speaking of snuggling yourself.
Speaking of snuggling myself, another quite liturgical story. It seems to be the theme.
It's a word and a half, huh?
Thank you. I did go to college. Miller's Coors being sued, just like Walmart, for not producing Coors Light in the Rockies, as they claim. So this is another sort of like...
Where is it?
I know.
Where do they make it?
Oh, just anywhere. Just anywhere. There's some water. Maybe a sewer.
Oh, come on.
And again, it's kind of a transparency and labeling issue. Mm. It's like, Miller's Coors, taste the Rockies. Well, you can't taste the Rockies if it's not made in the Rockies, right?
Saru, do you have any thoughts about Miller Coors not making their beer in the Rockies?
Not really.
is that not your favorite beer?
I don't drink it. It's fine.
You've got a lot more serious things
I actually really love is that Coors has been sued before, and they were sued last time because they claimed that Blue Moon was a craft beer. Which apparently it is not.
Well, I mean,
now I need to do college over because I did it wrong.
Well, I mean, people need to understand that like beer is a recipe and it can be made anywhere. It really can. So the only problem is if they really say that this is made with Rocky Mountain water. And a lot of breweries do that. And if they choose to not, then they can't expand in that way.
Right.
You can't do all the production for Coors that goes around the world in Colorado. I don't think the state's big enough.
But should you be charging the same for the Rocky Mountain water beer as you should for the like Schlocky Mountain beer?
I don't think that beer is very expensive, so I don't know that they're charging that much more for it.
Good point. I don't think people are like shelling out many dollars. So
apropos to the Parmesan at Walmart story,
everybody knows it's a farce.
But it's kind of un-American.
It's kind of un-American.
And I bet Trump has something to say.
I bet Trump is drinking his Coors Light with his well done steak, and he's mad about it. That's what we got. That's our food news, Jesse.
Thanks
for chiming
in,
guys.
Yeah.
You made it better.
Great. Thank you, guys.
We're going to take a break here. We're going to come back with Andrew Tarlow and Saru.
And Lee.
Jayaraman. This is the morning after.
It is.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you.
And we're back here on The Morning After. The concept of tipping has been ingrained in our culture of dining. Diners factor it into their meal, and servers or tipped employees rely on it to live. But the culture of tipping has recently come under fire, with more restaurant owners opting to get rid of the concept for what they say will be a fair wage for all restaurant workers. In studio today, restaurateur and hotelier Andrew Tarlow, who plans to get rid of tipping at all of his Brooklyn restaurants. And via phone, we have Saru Jayaraman, the director of Food and Labor Research Center at UC Berkeley and the co-founder of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United. Welcome to The Morning After, Saru and Andrew.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here.
So
in October of last year, really high-profile restaurateur Danny Meyer announced that he would get rid of tipping at all of his restaurants. I guess for Andrew, was this the... Do you guys feel, or Saru, do you feel like this was the catalyst for this anti-tipping movement, as many other restaurant groups have kind of, like, followed suit afterwards?
I mean, I can say for ourselves that we've been looking at it for about 3.5 years now. And we've kind of done a lot of the work behind the scenes. And I would say that with Danny's announcement, it sort of gave us the political bandwidth to really put it into place. So, yeah, Danny certainly had a lot to do with it. One last thing. I mean, from a fairness standpoint, we have been dealing with the issue of fair wages for our kitchen employees and our back-of-the-house employees since we've opened, and trying to figure out systems in place that we can control to kind of fix that. And we have been trying to do this for a while, and we have, you know, we didn't really have the political bandwidth to do it until sort of Danny did it. And obviously since Sarah's book has come out, and sort of like a consciousness of how restaurants really work and how these things are really what's happening.
Yeah, I just don't know what you mean. Like, why didn't you have the political bandwidth to do it? Like, what was blocking you at that point?
Well, I mean, Danny has been on the Today Show. He's been a New Yorker. He's been on Charlie Rose Show. He has spoken to a broad range of people about tipping.
But why couldn't you just do it?
Well, I guess I could have. I don't really have that kind of thought process to get on the Today Show or to be on Charlie Rose. No, I'm definitely focused on my employees and on my businesses. So I don't have like a big machine behind me working in that capacity. Like, my day is pretty day-to-day in terms of running these restaurants.
Mm-hmm. Is it more complicated because you have so many as opposed to just have... Like, I mean, I know Amanda Cohen did it for Dirt Candy, and that was even before Danny Meyer came out, pretty sure. And is that the difference, is that you have a bit of an empire as opposed to, like, just one restaurant?
Yeah, I mean, it's not an empire, but I definitely have a job to do on a daily basis, that, like, managing all the businesses and making sure that everyone's being taken care of and that, you know, the guests are being taken care of equally. It's definitely a full-time job, for sure.
And Saru, I guess I want to hear, you know, your feelings on Danny Meyer coming out with this.
Yeah, so we've been working on this issue for about 15 years since we started the organization. And
can you just tell us? Can you tell us what your organization is, Saru?
It's the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United, ROC United, and we're a national organization comprised of workers, employers, and consumers. So we have an employer association that Danny's company, Union Square Hospitality Group, has been a part of for about a decade. It's called RAISE. It includes about 200 amazing restaurant owners from around the country that really believe in better wages and working conditions and what we call the high road to profitability. So we've been working on this issue with, you know, Danny's company and others for a good decade, but from a different perspective. Our issue was not tipping itself. It's the fact that in this nation, tipping has allowed this industry to get away with paying workers as little as $2.13 an hour, which is the current legal federal minimum wage in 2016 for workers who earn tips, and it's between $2.13 and $7.50 in 43 states in the United States. The vast majority of workers who live on that abysmal wage are women. 70% are women. They're largely women who work at places like IHOP and Applebee's and Olive Garden. So we've been working on this issue of poverty and, frankly, sexual harassment, the fact that this two-tiered wage system is a legacy of slavery, for about a decade. And we had about half a dozen restaurants actually move in the direction of eliminating the two-tiered wage system over the last couple of years before then discussing it with Danny Meyer. And when we did last year, he said, you know, I've been thinking about this issue also for 20 years. Maybe it's time to actually move it forward. And so we worked with them over a period of months. And And, you know, and then the announcement happened, and have been working with many other restaurant owners around the country to do the same. But I'll reiterate, for the restaurants that are with us in our association, it's actually not just about eliminating tipping. That's not the core of the issue. The core of the issue is the fact that this industry has used tipping as an excuse to pay workers almost nothing and essentially get away with saying that consumers should pay our workers' wages. In fact, being the only industry on earth now, because we're the only nation that allows it, saying consumers should pay our workers' wages rather than we ourselves.
So I want to throw this to Andrew. What is the reality of restaurant wages? Why can't employees be paid a fair wage?
Well, I mean, in New York City, our situation is a little different. Our front of the house employees are our highest paid hourly employees of everyone in the company. So really what we're trying to do is move some of that money or a portion of it to the back of the house. We have a kind of internal goal to get everybody in the company at a minimum of $15 an hour. Obviously, our front of the house employees still get paid a higher hourly rate than that. But the economics of the restaurant business is that basically as you raise prices and or you raise costs because you're going to pay your back of the house more, we equally get a fundamental raise on the front of the house. So that wedge is clear and it just doesn't ever break. And so we had to remove tips in order to kind of change the wage system.
Saru, what has to happen before all restaurants can have the no tipping model?
Yeah, again, our goal is actually not to legislate or move all restaurants to the no tipping model. Our goal is what's called one fair wage, eliminating the lower wage for tipped workers, as seven states have successfully done, including California. California is actually the largest and fastest growing restaurant industry in the country, and it requires that all restaurants pay the same wage to workers who earn tips and those who don't. And tips are on top of that, and still there's very healthy rates of tipping in California. There are many restaurants in California that have moved to no tipping. But what we really need as a first step, you know, what we really, really need policy-wise is to have all states follow California and the seven states that have gotten away with this two-tiered system, which really is a legacy of slavery, because the original tipped workers in this country who were paid that $0 or $2 wage were former slaves. So what we really need is policy that will eliminate the lower wage for tipped workers and have all workers paid the same base minimum wage. And then many restaurants like Andrew's or Danny's or many others can choose to move beyond that to eliminate tipping altogether, which is fantastic as long as it's done in a way that's transparent and inclusive and ensures that workers are made whole. In other words, we wouldn't want a ton of restaurants moving on the bandwagon of no tipping and essentially taking the tips away from the workers and having them be worse off than they were when they were with tips. So our point is, let's as a first step policy-wise eliminate the lower wage for tipped workers, because it's the source of numerous evils, from poverty to sexual harassment to just all kinds of inequities between front and back and on and on. And once we've done that, I think you'll see a lot more restaurants move in the right direction, which could be the elimination of tipping, as long as, again, they're doing it in a way that makes their workers whole, getting them to where they would have been in tips, now through wages and income.
Saru, can you talk to us about what kind of policy action is happening? Is there a national policy movement at this point? Are you working on a bill, or are you sort of addressing state by state? Okay.
Yes, so there are bills moving in about seven states and ballot measures that will be on the November ballot this year. So there's bills moving in New York, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island. There's ballot measures that are going to be on the November ballot in Maine and Washington, D.C. And there's two bills in Congress moving right now, one that's being moved by Patty Murray and Bobby Scott in the Senate and the House, and the other that's being moved by Bernie Sanders and Keith Ellison. And both of these bills propose raising the overall minimum wage, one to 12, the other to 15, and fully eliminating, phasing out the lower wage for tipped workers. So this is great. It's historic. It's the first time in U.S. history that Congress has proposed just completely getting rid of this two-tiered system. And let me just say, a lot of the employers in our group, from Tom Colicchio to Danny Meyer to many, have said, actually, this two-tiered system isn't just a problem for workers. It's a real problem for employers, because there's tremendous liability that comes with employers having to ensure that tips make up the difference between the lower minimum wage and the regular minimum wage for every hour that a worker works.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like you're sort of acting as the liaison between, like, Congress and these restaurateurs at this point. Is that right?
That's right. A lot of these employers have come with us to Congress to say, we agree with this. We want one fair wage. We want to get rid of this lower wage for tipped workers. We want livable wages, because, like Andrew, they're doing the right thing. They're sticking their necks out, but it's competitive disadvantage. It's not a level playing field. So we want everybody, we want the standard to be right across the board, so that the fabulous high road restaurants that are doing it right don't feel like they're at a disadvantage for doing it right.
Sorry, you're working with, I guess with Danny Meyer, that's a very large group. Andrew's group is pretty big as well. You've worked with, In-N-Out has a great model. Chipotle is kind of following suit as well. But those are all really big groups. Is it possible for a small, like, restaurant, family-owned restaurant to follow this model? Can
Absolutely,
they pay someone
yeah.
that high wage?
Actually, the majority of restaurants in our 200 restaurant group are small mom-and-pop restaurants in very small parts of the country. There's Zingerman's in Ann Arbor, Michigan, that doesn't just pay a livable wage, they pay a thrivable wage. There's the Russell Street Deli in Detroit. There's the Florida Avenue Grill in Washington, D.C. There's Vimla's Curry Blossom Cafe in North Carolina. These are tiny mom-and-pop restaurants that have chosen to pay a livable wage, and our research shows that they're actually doing well, not in spite of paying their workers well, but actually because they're paying their workers well. They find less turnover, higher productivity, higher profitability, and we've been able to document that.
I feel like the biggest pushback I've heard from people in the industry are that service quality will go down. What do you think about that, Andrew?
I definitely heard it. We've definitely talked through. I feel like as an owner of restaurants, like, it is my responsibility to make sure that the guest experience is 100%. And so in the end of the day, the job of management and ownership is to make sure that those experiences are there. And like Sarah was talking about, is that if you have employees who are fully, engaged in the whole process and really are behind the systems, it's in their best interest. They're engaged in the whole company. They're engaged in the organization. They want to make sure that the guests have a really good experience. But in the same way, if you have a bad experience at one of my restaurants, it's my fault. That has nothing to do with tips, and it has nothing to do with the way that gratuity system is, the way I've set it up. So for me, I feel like I still take the same responsibility on both sides. I know that the European model, like, people, floated out there as like, well. But in the end, I think I own those places. I want them to be great experiences. I want you to be happy. It's my job.
I was just reading that Mario Batali, who I guess is kind of undecided about this
and
issue.
And he's got a big group. Very big group.
He's sort of unsure what he wants to do. But he was saying he really loves tipping. Like, he finds it a very gratifying thing to reward mm-hmm. service. So, are you going to let your servers accept tips if someone feels like they really yes. deserve it? It's going to make them feel good?
Yeah. So 100%, we've been, knee deep in this internal conversation. It's obviously a big cultural change for all of us. I think, this idea that you're a 25% tipper or you're a 15% tipper are real. We do allow tips. We don't have a tip line on a credit card. We are seeing about 4 to 5% tips still at Roman's, which is the only one that's gone gratuity-free at the moment. We are open to it. We still have not found the exact conversation that we all totally feel comfortable with. But we do recognize that if, it's your anniversary or you think this is an amazing experience, like, that you should be able to leave something for the team that's there. Again, we are making sure that everyone's paid equally up until that point. So it really is like a bonus on top of.
Sure.
We're not going to stop people.
We're not going to stop people for sure. Mm-hmm. So we have been open to it. And it's been, and I think it's something that we culturally will find an answer to in the next year or so. Right. Because we have to kind of process it and, like, talk to you and talk to lots of different people to kind of figure out where our place is. But, yeah, at this point, we are definitely accepting. There's definitely some money still floating in the restaurants.
Mm-hmm. Saro, it sounded like you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I just want to say all research pretty universally points to the fact that tipping is not correlated with service. Even the Cornell School of Hospitality Management has shown that tipping is actually correlated with your skin color and your eye color and your gender and your breast size, unfortunately, not really with the quality of your service. And so I think if you really think of this as a profession, which it is, this is a skilled profession. These are professional workers that serve us. It's hard work. It's really quality work. And so if we were to value them as professionals, as we do with any other profession, you can't imagine, like, you know, saying, I'm going to reward good service from a doctor or a teacher or a lawyer or any other customer service professional by how much I tip them. I mean, that would be insulting. It would be insulting to any other professional. And so why is it that we demean and devalue food service workers in this way, not just by saying, well, I want to be able to reward them for good service through my tip, which really needs to come from their employer, but also by saying they can be paid as little as $2, $3, and $4 an hour because of my tip. You know, that's just not, you have other ways to express your pleasure in other customer service professions. Why wouldn't we do that in this one as
well? Just say thank you.
Why is it sorrow? I mean, you know, from a historical point, but I mean, I'd love to just hear you kind of theorize. Like, why is there that schism between these professions?
Yes, it's, unfortunately, it is due to history. I mean, tipping didn't originate in the United States. It originated in the feudal homes of Europe. And when it came to the States, it was rich Americans traveling to Europe and trying to show off that they knew the rules of Europe. And unfortunately, that time period coincided with emancipation of the slaves. It was 1850s and 1860s. And there was a massive anti-tipping movement in America that said tipping is un-American, it's undemocratic. That was so successful that 6 states actually passed complete bans on tipping. And that movement was squashed by the restaurant industry, the Restaurant Association, and the Pullman Train Company, both of which wanted the right to hire newly freed slaves and not pay them anything and let them live on customer tips. And that idea that this industry could be the only one, because actually in the Pullman Train Company example, the workers actually organized and got the right to form the first black union in the United States and won the right to an actual wage rather than relying on tips. But in the case of the restaurant industry, the workers weren't as lucky. There was no union that would accept them. I mean, this is the labor movement's racist history as well. And so these workers were left behind as really the only workers now on earth. That the law from the beginning as part of the New Deal said that these workers could be paid $0 and live on tips. And we've gone from a $0 minimum wage in 1938 to a whopping $2.13 an hour almost a century later, only for restaurant workers. I mean, there are a few other workers that live on this wage, you know, nail salon workers, but it's in vast majority restaurant workers, and it is because of this horrible historical legacy and the advocacy of a trade lobby that really represents the Fortune 500 chains like Applebee's and Olive Garden.
Do you guys, as someone who's worked in management and also worked as a tipped employee, do you feel like any roles or certain job titles are going to be non-existent? I'm working as a wine director and a sommelier right now. Does that sommelier job need to exist anymore if they are a tipped and hourly employee? It feels like restaurateurs would probably want to still cut corners and not have as many people on the floor because they're paying an hourly wage.
It's not service oriented.
If it's not, I mean, it is service oriented, but like, why can't a server do that or why can't the manager do that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky one. I think for us, like culturally, we have always been in a position where we've been shaving our front of the house staff down to keep the tip pool as tight as possible so that everyone makes as much money. So we don't come from a place where we're just like, yeah, let's just add more people and like diminish how much money they're going to make. We're advocates for our employees and we want to make sure that they make as much money as possible. That's why this process was sort of, I mean, it hasn't been easy, but it's easier. Again, you know, I think it's about, you know, so we talked about this high road. I think it's really about thinking about a long-term business model where you're trying to make the most successful business possible. And how do you define success? Well, you define success by taking care of all the employees and making sure that they are all making money, right? So in that capacity, you're going to put as many people as possible as you need to take care of your guests and that you need to make sure everyone gets paid, right?
So yeah.
It depends on the ownership and like where management stands in terms of what their ideals are. You know?
Yeah, and I would add, we have plenty of sommeliers in California where we have the same wage for tipped and non-tipped workers and much higher wages. Actually, San Francisco, as you know, and LA have passed $15 wages, minimum wages for all workers, tipped and non-tipped. And we have faster job growth in the restaurant industry, higher restaurant sales per capita, and even faster job growth among tipped workers. So we have found the opposite to be true, that actually there are more sommeliers and more tipped workers in places that provide higher wages. And then partly it's because the economy does better when these workers do better. They tend to spend in their own industry.
Yeah. Can we put you on the mic, Lee?
Yeah.
You want to speak? Okay. Lee, you're the chef at Achilles Heel, which is one of Andrew's restaurants, and you've worked at many of his restaurants. So how does this affect you? I mean, you sort of represent the kitchen.
Yeah, you represent the back of house.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. It's difficult for a back of house employee to kind of make a living wage. And I think the bigger problem kind of manifests itself in, like, the kitchen's bigger problems, which is staffing the kitchen. There's so much turnover in kitchens. The people that are there are doing it because they love what they do.
Well, no, it's true. I mean, it's a huge problem that I hear from chefs. They're constantly complaining they can't find reliable and skilled workers in their kitchens, and I think this will change that.
Yeah, cooks kind of shop around at restaurants. They'll go from one restaurant to another, and this cycle will go on for about six months until they. I'm kind of losing my...
No, that's okay. They find something better. I mean, I understand. I mean, as someone who's worked in restaurant management, you see people coming in and out, like, training for a couple days, and then they're gone, or training for a few months, and then maybe they find something better. Or they can really pick and choose because it's such but so many people are looking for cooks that a lot of cooks can really pick and choose.
And so many young people coming right out of culinary school at this point in time, like, they don't want to work on the line. Like, they don't want to do that. And they feel entitled. Like, they see, lots of young chefs happening and having great success, and they don't want to necessarily, spend time, like, chopping vegetables. Like, they want to go right into becoming, like, a restaurant owner.
Yeah. Being successful in a kitchen is all about putting in that hard work.
Right.
And taking that time. And it just doesn't happen. And if it's 6 months at a restaurant, you need to, like, really dedicate yourself to the task and the job. And I mean, it's difficult to sustain that lifestyle.
It's kind of hard.
Long hours and
Really hard on you. You're not making enough money to afford the kind of food that's served in the restaurant you're working, I mean, that's a fundamental issue.
Right, and to spend all your time there in those conditions, and then to have front of the house employees that work definitely half the time, probably less. It's disheartening.
Yeah.
It's really difficult.
So, Saru, how optimistic are you about the policy change?
I'm really optimistic. I'm sure you all have noticed there's a wave of minimum wage increases happening around the country.
Absolutely.
And to the point that was just made, these minimum wage increases and what we're calling one fair wage is really just as beneficial to back-of-the-house workers as it is to front-of-the-house. I mean, when the minimum wage goes up to $15 for all workers, I think you'll start to see... We're hearing what the chef was just saying all over the country, like, worst labor shortage in the back-of-the-house in this industry's history that most people have ever seen. And part of it is, the wages in the back-of-the-house, especially after going to culinary school, just can't compete with lots of other professions. And in some cases... even with fast food jobs that in some cases are starting to pay more than back-of-the-house culinary jobs. And so why would you spend all your time becoming a culinary professional to find that somebody at In-N-Out can make more than you?
Mm-hmm.
That just doesn't make sense. So I think that's why the success that we're seeing in more and more cities and states past $15 for all workers, tipped and non-tipped, and start to move towards greater parity, as Andrew was saying, between front and back, That's really, really heartening. I mean, we've never seen so much momentum around these issues, both policy-wise and in the industry, in 15 years of working on this issue.
Well, I guess with the raise of the minimum wage, does that mean that it's going to actually be put back onto the consumer? They're going to have to pay more for what they're getting?
Yeah, we're not seeing higher prices in California or the seven states that have the same wage for tipped and non-tipped workers. I mean, I think people really have to keep in mind that labor is a key cost, but it's not the only cost. Rent costs have gone way up for restaurants. Food prices have skyrocketed over the last couple of years, and you've not seen really huge menu price increases as a result. And you don't see huge menu price increases in California. I mean, honestly, I spend more every time I come to New York or Washington, D.C. than when I'm here in California eating in a normal restaurant. And it's because restaurants in California and the West Coast, where wages are much higher, have worked it into their business model and are thriving. And I mentioned there's all kinds of other added benefits to higher wages, from less turnover. I mean, this is the industry with the highest turnover rates of any industry in the United States. That the average is something like 300%. That means three turns in one position in 1 year. And we've quantified that. That's horribly costly to most employers. I mean, think about the tree training and the hiring and the search. It's just, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, there's a lot of short-sightedness. Oh, let's pay as little as we can, and that means we can keep costs low. And it also means ridiculous churn. And when you raise wages, you don't see, like, immediate or immense menu price increases. Now, you would if you get rid of tipping. That's a different story. But if you're just raising the base wage, you know, it's most of these policies require doing that over an 8 to 10 year period. So they're phased in, maybe $1 or $1.50 increase in wages year after year. You're not seeing tremendous menu price increases as a result.
Mm-hmm. And Andrew, what are you doing in the community as a restaurateur, as kind of like a model or like a pillar of teaching this business model to people so they can try and create a similar one?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So we have tried, we are as transparent as possible. I mean, if anyone wants to reach out, we're happy to, like, share what we have learned and what we know. We created a logo that we put up for free to, like, let anyone have access to use as a sort of a, you know, a logo so that people can see that this is a gratuity-free restaurant.
They put it on the window or something?
They can put it on their door, or they could use it on their menus to kind of give them a sense, because there is a raise in prices and in terms of, you know, incurring those costs. And equally, like, you know, we have sort of part of, like, what, I mean, a 2.0 or 3.0 idea is that in the past, having half my employees be tipped really tied my hands in terms of what I could ask them to do or what I could say, like, let's go do. Let's just say, you know, you guys were interested in a school next door, and I could say, like, okay, well, you know, on work hours where I pay you, let's go down to that school and go help them, right? As tipped employees, that's not legal, right? 80% of your work needs to be tied exactly towards the tables. So even as an organization and as a company, we can now start looking outside of our doors in a very real way and ask, what do we want to do in our community? Not only within restaurants, not only with our own employees, not only with taking care of ourselves, but are there other things? And this gives us that kind of freedom as an organization, which we didn't really have prior.
Wow. And Sarah, how can restaurateurs get in touch with you and your organization?
Yeah, we'd love them to consider joining RAISE, our High Road Employer Association, if they're interested in learning from their peers on how they can follow the high road and how to make the move to either eliminate tipping or the tip minimum wage. And they can do that by going to our website, looking up RAISE, which is our High Road Employer Association, Restaurants Advancing Industry Standards and Employment. So it's RAISE. And our website is www.rocunited.org.
Great. Well, Saru and Andrew, thank you so much for joining in the conversation with us.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks,
guys.
Lee.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
We're going to take a break here on The Morning After. We'll come back with The Morning After Quiz. We're back here on The Morning After. Andrew Tarlow is your last name, and you know that. But did you know it rhymes with legendary blonde bombshell Jean Harlow's last name? I'm stretching. And she is the morning after topic of your quiz today.
Is she stretching? You ready? That's what I really want to know.
Is she stretching in the grave, rolling over in the grave, yep. Jean Harlow? All right, first question. Born Harlene Harlow Carpenter.
What?
Jean Harlow wasn't her only nickname. This is what she thought her name was until the age of five. So, multiple choice. Which of these did she think her name was until the age of five? Is it A, Baby, B, Blondie, or C, Dimples?
Wow.
You can help. You can help out.
I'm going to go C, Dimples.
C, Dimples. Agree. C, Dimples is not correct. It's actually Baby. And Baby. On her tomb, it says, like, you know, here lies Baby or something like that. Okay. I wonder if that's where Baby came from Dirty Dancing. What do you think?
Baby. I think so, yeah.
Baby the dinosaur?
I don't know Baby. Oh, that movie? Yeah. I don't remember Baby the Dinosaur.
We'll talk about Dirty Dancing.
80s. But okay. 1980s.
Baby. You know, nobody puts Baby in the corner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Baby. Anyway.
You mean Lost in Time?
No, it's another one. It's like a live-action dinosaur movie.
I can't believe
they
I missed
it.
We'll talk
baby.
About that.
Yeah. Okay, we'll talk about that later.
All right, second question. In Madonna's legendary 1990 Ode to Old Hollywood Glamour song, Vogue, she lists 16 stars, including Jean Harlow, whose name appears before Harlow's. Is it A, Grace Kelly? Is it B, Katharine Hepburn? Or is it C, Marlena Dietrich?
Good question.
I'm going to go A.
Gonna go A. Grace Kelly, exactly.
Yes,
Grace Kelly, Harlow Jean, picture of a beauty queen.
Good job.
Can we cue the music now?
I don't think we have the rights to that. By the way,
sorry.
we're getting no. We're getting a definitive no.
I'm pretty sure Madonna would be real serious about that.
Grace Kelly, Fred Astaire.
No, it's Jean Kelly, Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, Danced on Air.
Danced on Air.
Nice. Okay.
Final question. In her first major role in the Howard Hughes film Hell's Angels, critics were not impressed with her performance. Which of these is not a line from one of her reviews? Is it A, from The New Yorker, "Dollface aside, she's plain awful."
That's good.
From Life magazine, "She's got about as much appeal as a canceled stamp."
Okay.
Or is it C, from Variety magazine, "It doesn't matter what degree of talent she possesses, nobody has ever starved possessing what she's got."
Ooh. A and B sound era, like of the era. C does not.
Back in the day when you could just say whatever.
So
you
I'm going to go C.
You know, actually, C was a thing that they said about her.
Yes!
No, you're wrong.
What do you mean?
Which of these was not from one of her
I got the question wrong. I wasn't even listening properly.
All right, fine. We'll give you that one, kind of.
Kind of.
Okay.
Kind of.
That's a, yeah.
Yeah, they, I mean, yeah. She was pretty hot, so they were like, she's not going to starve. That lady will be fine. Okay. Anyway, yeah. The one I made up was the canceled stamp, and I did look up slang from the 1930s to figure that one out. And
it
means a really, like, dull wallflower.
The first one, they really said that to her?
Oh, yeah. Doll face aside, she's plain awful. Yeah.
Gosh, that's so mean.
Yeah. It was The New Yorker. I mean, lots of opinions there, right?
Yeah.
It's just, they make it a little more flowery these days.
Exactly. Well, thank you for joining in on the Morning After Quiz,
thank
Andrew.
You guys.
And again, Lee, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Saru, she's off the phone now, but it was a great interview.
Thank you,
and
Saru.
Thank you guys. It's an important topic. So
yeah.
We will talk to you next week here on The Morning After.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.